这个公司也是Okay, so let's get started. Okay, so welcome to 377. It's going to be a smaller than usual class, as you probably have guessed. Usually we have about 50 students in 377. This time it's half the number. Hopefully that will make it more interactive and more fun. So I look forward to having lots of interesting discussions on OS topics. So what I'm going to do today is a quick introduction. Because basically we'll cover the syllabus, tell you guys a little bit about what the course is going to cover and things like that. Next class is where we'll actually start looking at the first chapter of the book. Okay, so let me introduce myself. So as you know, I'm the instructor. My name is Prashant Ashinoy. And I have the TA here, Anthony Partensky. Okay. The two of us are going to be staffing this course. I will lead the lectures. Anthony is going to lead the discussion section. Okay, so you'll be seeing a lot of us over the next 3 months or so. Alright, so what I'll do is talk about the course organization, outline, describe the policies a little bit, and then I haven't fainted in heat by then. talk a little bit about operating systems. Okay, so that's the URL for the course. Everything that I will show you here will be posted on the course webpage. Today's lecture notes are already there. Okay, so I will post the slides maybe an hour before the class. So if you have access right before then, just download the slides, bring them to you, take notes. If not, you can find them right after class. Okay. As I said, Anthony is the TA. He's going to lead the discussion section. There is one tomorrow, so be sure to come. Okay, we'll also hand out the first pseudo lab tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. Okay, so as you probably know, there are prerequisites for this class. Most of you, if you have already registered in Spire, have probably met the prerequisite. But just to be clear, it's assumed that you know something about data structures, some basic knowledge of architecture which used to be covered in 201. Okay, so, or if you haven't taken those two courses, then 291SP, which is a new course, is going to be the new prerequisite for 377. Okay, most of you probably haven't taken this one, it's taught for the first time this semester, but presumably you have that background. Okay, textbook is Operating System Concepts by Silberschatz. There are several editions of this book. New one seems to come out every year for reasons I don't understand. Not much has changed. So pretty much any of the recent edition should work. The latest one is the 8th edition. If you get a used 7th edition for cheap, by all means. Okay, there isn't that much difference between the two. Okay, if you have a choice, get the Java edition of the book. There's a C edition, there's a C++, there's a Java version. Get the Java version. Okay, because the course will be done in Java. All the assignments, etc. will be in Java. Okay? There's another book. So I will put a couple of copies of this book on reserve in the library. Okay, so if you don't have the book, you can use the library copy. There's another suggested book that is something you don't have to buy. But it will be on reserve in the library. You might want to go and read up on it. It's the Tannenbaum's operating system text. Okay, it's also a good book. I will occasionally use material from that, but you don't need to have access to that book all the time. Okay, a reference copy in the library is good enough. Course requirements. Basically, the course has three components: exams, programming assignments, and homework/class exercises. Okay. There will be six or so thereabouts, okay, maybe five, maybe six homework assignments plus several in-class exercises. Okay, that will be 15% of the grade. There will be, that's actually a typo, there will be four programming assignments, but only three will count towards the grade. The first one that's going to be handed in tomorrow will not count towards the grade, you still have to turn it in. Okay, that's just a Java refresher. Okay, so there will be four assignments, but only three will actually count, and those three will count towards 45% of the grade, 15% each. Okay, three exams, 40%, two midterms and a final. Okay, so that's basically how the course is going to be graded. Alright, so there are policies on turning things in late, there are policies on cheating. The cheating policy is very simple, you shouldn't. There are policies on turning things in late, there are exceptions, etc. They are all spelled out in the detailed syllabus on the course webpage. Okay, I presume nobody needs a hard copy, right? You can go access the syllabus on the course webpage, which has 2-3 paragraphs describing each of these policies. Okay. Unfortunately, this building doesn't have wireless access, otherwise I would have shown it to you here. Okay, so you'll have to make do with that. Course, some miscellaneous thing, you have all accounts on the EdLab. You don't have to use it. If you have your own machine, laptop, etc., by all means do your assignment on your machine. The only thing you should be aware of is when you turn in a programming assignment, make sure it runs exactly the same on the EdLab. Okay? Since it's all Java, if you have the same version of Java installed on your local machine as on the EdLab, things should be fine, but just do check that. Okay? Because the assignments will be graded on the EdLab. Okay? If it runs on your machine but not on the EdLab, there is no way for us to know all that. Okay? So the only reason you have to use the EdLab account is to make sure your things run. You can program wherever you want. There's no restriction on that. Okay? There is a discussion section that will be held every week. The discussion will supplement the lectures. Most of the discussion sections will focus on practical aspects of operating systems, which for this course means the programming assignment. Because that is where you will learn something about how OS concepts actually work in practice. Threading, synchronization, memory management, and those kinds of things. Okay, so I have so here are office hours. So my office hours will always be immediately after class. Okay, the advantage of this is if you have a question that comes up in class, you can see me right afterwards. Okay, so I have office hours twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Okay, that isn't right. That should be 3:45 to 4:45. Okay, so if I do 2:45, I cannot do it. So I'll be here. That's a typo. So right after class, an hour after class, you can stop by. You can send me email and stop by at other times as well. Okay. Anthony has office hours also. Do you know when they are, or should we announce it next week?
So I will have office hours right after the discussion for 1 hour, and then 1 other hour sometime during the week. I'm thinking in the Monday or Friday, and I just run it by you guys tomorrow and see what's better. Okay.
So 4 of the 5 working days of the week, one of us has office hours. Okay, so pretty much if you have a question, you can get it answered the same day, most likely. Alright, so Tuesdays and Thursdays I'll have office hours. Anthony has office hours right after the discussion section, that's on Wednesdays, and one more on either Monday or Friday to be announced. Okay, I think Anthony's office hours will likely be near the EdLab. Okay, just because most of the questions you might ask him might have to do with the discussion section. Okay, but we'll announce the room and the times shortly. Okay, so mine are already here. His we will get back to you. Okay, so that is okay. So projects, I said there will be 4 assignments. The first one you have to turn in, but it will not count towards your grade. All of them will be in Java. Okay, not some versions of 377 do assignments in C and C++. This is a slightly different variant of the OS course. It will be all done in Java. Okay, this is sometimes advantageous to continue to use the same programming language, and sometimes it's good to learn new ones. In this iteration of 377, you will not learn a new language, okay, but you will learn OS concepts in Java. Any comments, questions about that? Was anyone looking forward to C++? No. Okay, you are looking forward. Well, not this time. So we will not use autograder. Okay, if you know what autograder is, if you haven't heard about it, don't worry about it. You will turn in your assignment and we will grade it manually. Okay? Everything will be turned in through Spark. I presume you have at least used Spark in some, at least one other course, hopefully. If not, you will learn about it this time. Okay, so that's our course management system. Your homeworks will be turned in on Spark. Your programming assignments will be turned in on Spark. Everything is logged. There is nothing that can get lost. Okay, you don't have to come in to turn it, you just have to basically a web browser access and you can turn in your assignments from anywhere. Okay, so that way we know when you turn everything in, your grades will be sent back to you via Spark. So everything will be recorded and you will have instant access to grades, etc. Okay, so it's pretty convenient and that's what we will continue to use. So if you don't know what Spark is, you should know, you should find out. We will probably put a link to it, but it's not very difficult to use, but it's something you should keep in mind. Okay, cheating policy, this is all obvious, but I would like to at least say something about it. Some of the programming assignments will have commonalities with what we have used in the past. Okay, but as always, anything you turn in should be always your own work. Okay, don't try to borrow code from last year's students, don't try to borrow code from the internet, is not acceptable. Okay, you have to do your own work. We will allow you to work in groups to make life easier for you. Okay, you don't have to form a group, but if you would like to work with somebody to sort of share the burden of doing the assignments, that is fine. Okay, given that we have all of this flexibility, it's understood that anything that you turn in will be your own. We will use automated checking program that will compare your code with a database of prior assignments. So if you actually turn something in that borrows thing, it will find it automatically. Okay, so so I'm just mentioning this so that you know that we are serious about this. So please don't take something from someone. Always do your own work. Okay. All of these things are clearly not acceptable. Okay, hiring somebody to do your assignments and whatnot. Okay, quick note about cell phone and laptop policy. Cell phones clearly not something you should be using in class. No texting allowed. Laptops, I have sort of debated on this. I don't see anybody with laptops. That's actually a good thing. Okay, until recently, I would allow laptops in class, but it only for class use, which is taking notes. But then it started becoming a distraction, because if you have wireless access, then you don't listen to what's happening here. You are doing Twitter or Facebook or something like that, and you are not listening. So the default policy is that you shouldn't use laptops in lectures. Okay? You can use them in the discussion section for coursework. Okay? But in lectures, by default, you cannot use them. If you really think you need to take notes in class, come talk to me. Okay, we'll try to see whether something can be done about that, but I would prefer that if you come here, you pay attention to what I'm saying. I'm not making it mandatory that you attend. Okay, if you feel like you want to sit and do Facebook, that's fine, but don't do it here. Okay, so that's sort of our policy. So if you have cell phones, try to turn the ringer off. Sometimes cell phones go off anyway. Mine went off last semester, unfortunately, we'll try to do what we can to prevent that and distracting people. Okay, clearly you shouldn't be texting and things like that. Alright, so any questions on the course policies? I'll talk about the topics now, but anything on the assignments, anything I said so far? Oh, everything is clear. Okay. So the course actually is a standard operating system course. It has four components, the same four components that are in the book. Okay, these are the key components of an operating system as well. The first big piece is processes and threads, okay? Also known as process and thread management. We'll spend several lectures on processes and threads starting next week. Okay. Then the next big component is going to be memory management. How does the operating system manage the RAM on your machine? Okay, we'll again spend several classes on that. Then we'll spend a few classes talking about storage and file systems, which is how does your OS manage the disk on your machine. Okay, that's the storage and file system. And the last component is distributed system. Okay, this is basically how does the OS manage the network, which is the Wi-Fi card or the Ethernet card, and how do applications communicate with one another. Okay, we'll have a few lectures on that. Okay, so this topic is actually really a graduate level topic, with an entire course I teach on that topic alone, but I will provide a quick 3-4 lecture introduction to distributed systems here. Alright, so that's basically the outline of the course. That's also the order on which we will cover these topics. Okay, we'll start with processes and threads, two classes from now. Today I will just do a very quick introduction of operating systems, next class I'm going to do a very quick introduction to computer architecture. Yeah, the 201 stuff that you should know, but you might have forgotten. So I'll do a refresher on the architecture stuff, because you need to know some stuff to know operating systems. And then we'll talk about processes. Any questions on this? Yeah. Are we going to have discussion? There will be a discussion tomorrow. What we will do is actually hand out the first lab, because we haven't done anything to actually discuss from the lecture standpoint. But we will hand out the first lab assignment, which is a very simple Java program that you need to write. The objective of that assignment is not really an operating system lab assignment. It's really a Java assignment to know whether you know enough Java to survive the assignments that are coming down the road. Okay, if you have a lot of difficulty finishing lab 1, it is imperative that you come see me. Okay, because it might be the case that you don't know enough Java to do what is coming down the road. Because it's really, I mean, it's not a very difficult assignment. If you have done any Java programming, it should be fairly straightforward. Okay, it is mandatory to turn it in, but as I said, we will grade it, but the grade won't count towards the final grade. It's just for us to know that you all have enough background in Java. Okay, so tomorrow's lab has a discussion section. Coming back to the question, tomorrow's discussion section is where the assignment will be handed out and discussed. Okay? Alright, so any other questions before I do a very quick introduction? I mean, this is going to be a short class. I'll just do a quick intro to operating systems and then we'll end and see if there are any other questions. Okay. So, very quick introduction. Okay, so this is sort of a very high level introduction to what an operating system is. So let's start with the definition of an operating system. Okay, so the definition has changed over the years, but essentially what is the whole operating system? It is a layer of software that sits between the hardware on your machine and the applications that run on the machine. Okay, so it's the thing that sits in between. Okay, it manages the hardware on behalf of the application. So it's an interface between the user, okay, and the architecture. That's the more formal definition. And another way to think about it is it provides you a logical abstraction, okay, of a machine, of the physical machine, that is easier to use than the actual raw hardware. Okay, so essentially what does the OS do? It hides the details of what is inside the machine. Okay, the fact that there is a disk, you don't really need to know the low level details. Okay, it gives you higher level abstractions of files. It figures out where to store the file. It figures out when you open a file where to fetch the data from. You, the user, doesn't need to deal with all of those issues. Same is true of RAM. When you start a new application, it figures out how much memory to give to that application. It figures out where to load that application in memory. Excuse me. So you as the user don't need to deal with it. Okay? So what it has done is it's taken raw hardware and provided an easier, more convenient interface for applications and the user. Okay, so this makes it much easier for you to use your machine and be productive at the things you do. You don't need to worry about all these low-level details of the hardware. Okay, so that's really the goal of the operating system. Okay, so the term OS has been misused quite a bit. Some people have said the browser is essentially the operating system and whatnot. But I mean, we will use a more formal definition of operating system. Okay. Here's a picture of what I just said. Okay, so this is the hardware. This is your bare-bone machine. That's the piece of software that is sitting between these two. Okay, so you take the physical machine interface, which is the processor, the instruction sets on the machine, the memory and so on, and you provide a virtual machine interface. Okay, which is basically a logical abstraction of what your memory looks like. It's a logical abstraction of what the disk on your machine looks like and so on. Okay? So it hides lots of low-level details to make it easier to use. Okay? And another way to think of the operating system is that it's a resource manager. Okay? Given a certain number of applications that are running concurrently on your machine, the operating system decides how much resources to give to each. Okay? It decides if you have Firefox running and your Word and PowerPoint all running, how much RAM to give to each, okay, how much CPU to give to each, okay, and so on and so forth. So it basically, think of it as a government, that it takes limited resources and it divides it across among all the processes or the application that are running on that machine at any given time. Okay? So various definitions, but at the end of the day, they basically all say the same thing in different ways. Okay? So that's what the OS is. Okay. So the area is not new. Okay? The first operating systems were designed back in the 60s for mainframes. Okay? But they have continued to evolve since then. Okay, so then the mainframe operating system, then the PC operating system, starting with DOS and Windows and whatnot, and they continue to evolve. Okay? And the definition of what is actually an operating system has continued to also evolve with the technology. And there are new areas where operating systems are sort of still an active area of research. Okay? There is, as the OS kernel itself, the operating systems are fairly mature. There's continuous development, like Linux kernel and the Windows kernel and the Mac OS X kernel continue to evolve, but they're not active areas of research. I mean, some people do research, but not a whole lot. Most of the work is actually happening on at a higher level. So if you look at the web, what operating systems do you use to control clusters of machines that run web applications? By the word of the term grid computing and cloud computing and whatnot. So that is where people are designing specialized operating systems that run for these new environments that are coming. Okay, so that's an active area of research. Another area of research is as the hardware evolves, how should the operating system evolve? Okay, that's also an active area of research. So think of recent development. So now you have tablets everywhere. Okay, how should the operating system change? Because the interface that users use to interact with the hardware has changed. You no longer have a keyboard and a mouse, you have a touch interface. Right? What should be the interface that the operating system exposes to application developers? How should it control these new resources? Okay, namely the screen, touch sensitive screen and so on. So that's a change in hardware has triggered changes in the operating system. Okay, another change is all of the current hardware that you can buy on the market today, they are all multi-core. Okay, 5 years ago, if you had to buy more than one processor on a machine, you had to buy a multi-processor machine that was very expensive. Now, by default, anything you buy, even a $300 laptop, has at least two cores. Yes, most machines will have 4, 8, 16 cores as processors evolve. So one question you ask is, then how should the operating system evolve as multiple cores become very common? Okay. What application API should you expose? How should the applications change to these or react to these hardware changes? Okay. That's another area that is influencing the design of operating system. Okay. And then there is this whole open source community where number of operating systems are in active development. They continue to evolve. Okay. Linux being the most well known, but there are several others, BSD and other flavors of BSD. Okay? And if some of you may have used these open source operating systems, some of you may even contributed to their design. Okay? So that is another area where OS continues to evolve. Okay, as we go along, we will see several examples of how Linux works and OS X works and Windows works throughout the course. So you'll get some feel for how these operating system platforms make different design decisions. Okay. So now let's look a little bit about some of the key features of an operating system. So the first one is several services that the OS provides to applications and to users. Okay. There are numerous services. I mentioned some of them. There's the file system. That's the storage service. Okay. That's what the file operating system uses to store persistent data. Okay. Data that doesn't go away if you reboot your machine. There is the memory subsystem, which basically provides the illusion of essentially infinite memory on your machine. Okay? Your machine might actually have a certain amount of RAM, let's say 2 gigabyte or 4 gigabyte. But what the operating system does is it provides the illusion of essentially infinite memory to applications. Okay? So you can run more than one application at the same time, and the total memory demands of these applications might exceed the size of RAM, and yet they all continue to run, even though all of the processes may not fit in RAM at the same time. Okay? That's a useful service. How do you take a limited size RAM and make it look like it's infinite to application? Okay? That's a service that OS provides. When we do virtual memory, we'll come back to this. Okay? Networking is obviously a very useful service. The ability to access resources on the network, whether it's a web page somewhere on a server, or it's a file sitting on some other server, or a network printer. Okay, all of this requires that your machine be networked. Okay, so what does the networking subsystem look like? What does the operating system do to allow processes to communicate. Okay, that's another useful service. And the last one is process management, which includes time sharing, CPU scheduling and whatnot. So what this service allows you to do is run more than one application at the same time. Okay, so you may have a number of apps open, each of them may have multiple threads. So what is it that the OS needs to do to enable these processes and threads to all run concurrently? Okay, that's yet another service. And as we go along, we will actually visit them in not this order. We'll start, as I said, with process management, then we'll do memory management, I/O, and then networking. Okay, so there's one way to look at how an OS is actually sort of compartmentalized. Another way to think about it is coordination. Okay, how does how does the OS coordinate resources between applications and users? Okay, and examples of this coordination lie in each of these components. Okay, so in process management, you have concurrency. This is the ability to run more than one process at the same time concurrently. In the context of memory subsystem, you have memory protection. What this does is prevents one process from accessing the RAM that has been assigned to some other process. This is done for security reasons, so you don't accidentally go and trample on some other process's memory. So that's a service that the operating system provides. And then there is security. Security sort of resides at multiple levels. It resides at the file level, it might reside at the network level, it resides in the memory subsystem as well. This basically allows you to provide some degree of security and privacy to applications and users and prevent some other users, other applications from accessing your data. Okay, so how that's another service that the application provides. Okay. Now the goal of an operating system designer should be to design a platform, a kernel, that basically makes it convenient for the user to use that piece of hardware. Okay. So then the question is, how will you go about designing what functionality goes in each of these components? Okay. What should the file system look like? Okay. What should the memory management policies look like? What CPU scheduling policies should you employ? And by no means is there a single answer to any of these. Okay. There are tens of different file systems out there. Okay. What's the right one to put on a particular machine? Depends on the needs of the applications and the user. But as an operating system designer, you have to make the call. So if you are building a new kernel, what kind of file system would you put on that? So would you design a new one? Would you take one that exists and port it? What interface should you provide? And so on. Okay, that same thing is true for virtual memory, same thing is true for CPU scheduling and so on. Okay, that's really at some level a software engineering problem. Okay, so you are making basically design decisions of what functionality to put. The other thing an operating system designer needs to do is to make the operating system kernel as efficient as possible, so that your apps run as fast as possible. Okay, the operating system layer is bloated, so application performance is going to suffer. Okay, if some of these policies are not the right ones for that machine, then again application performance takes a hit. Okay, so efficiency and functionality and convenience are sort of two key design goals. They are not necessarily design goals for an operating system. Any large piece of software you design, okay, be it a database or any other piece of software, you really have to answer those two questions. Okay, what functionality to put in and how to make the system efficient. Okay, this is no different here. Okay, the decisions you will make will be different, because a database will be not similar to an operating system from a design standpoint, so you will make different choices. But the notion of functionality and efficiency come up in any large software system design. Okay. So some other issues are, I already mentioned this abstraction issue. What kind of interface would you expose to the user? Okay. How do you provide the illusion of infinite memory? How do you provide the illusion of lots of CPU power or other kinds of resources? Okay. What is it that you need to do to actually provide that abstraction to end users? Okay. And a lot of choices that you will have to make will involve trade-offs. Okay. They will not be straightforward. If you try to make one thing better, it is often at the expense of something else. Okay. So you will have to make the right trade-off, saying, do you actually do more of this and less of that. And this happens all the time. Okay, so when we do CPU scheduling, okay, which is the first major topic, we'll visit this because there are different policies. Some policies try to optimize response time seen by users. Other policies optimize throughput seen by jobs. Okay? If you try to optimize response time, that may be at the expense of throughput and vice versa. Okay? Because you can't actually do both at the same time. So as an operating system designer, you have to weigh these choices. You have to make the right design decisions. Okay? So performance and convenience is one. Sometimes when you add more functionality, that makes the kernel more bloated and performance can take a hit. Okay, is that an acceptable choice? Okay, you can make the world's fastest operating system by putting the fewest features possible. Okay, so you want to try to, there is a thing there, if you want to shut that, it will probably stop the wind. Oops. Okay, you just have to. Okay, just push this in. So performance and convenience, performance and simplicity, these are all design trade-offs. Okay, you cannot have both. You have to pick one or the other or sort of find the right balance. Okay, so those are design decisions, and we'll see as we come up with these topics on process scheduling, memory management, how to make the right decisions for different types of systems. Okay, so, and I already mentioned this, so OS is basically the point where hardware and software meet. Okay, the OS is sort of the lowest level in your software stack. It is basically the thing that runs on bare hardware or on bare metal. And all the processes basically run under the supervision of the operating system kernel. So this is basically the lowest layer in any software stack. So you are really programming when you write operating system kernel, you are actually programming at a very low level. You are programming directly against the hardware. When you write an application, you are actually programming against some library or some API. Maybe it's the Java API or C or C++ API. So this is basically the lowest level in the software stack. So it requires a good understanding of how the hardware works. Okay, this is the reason 201 is a prerequisite. You need to know something about the hardware in order to understand operating systems, and you better know a lot if you're writing an operating system kernel. So, as I was mentioning, one of the goals of this course is not just to expose you to the design of operating system. Some of the principles that you will come across here are more universal principles. They apply to any large software system design. You will have to make similar design trade-offs. But we will sort of try to understand these trade-offs in the context of an operating system. Okay, so that's something you want to keep in mind. And like in any large software system, our goal is to build a kernel that is fast, that is reliable, and that scales, okay, and provides the right set of functionality to its end user. So those are things you should keep in mind. And I'll come to things like clusters and distributed computing later on in this course. At that point, we will see how the basic concepts we have studied can be enhanced to sort of work across multiple machines for larger systems and so on. But initially, we are not going to focus on this. We'll just take a single machine, single CPU, some RAM and some disk, and try to understand how to build a OS kernel for this one small machine. Okay, and as we sort of progress down the course, we'll see how you can enhance these concepts and have your OS kernel run across multiple machines and whatnot. Okay, so what I will do next, that's sort of a very quick introduction. Now I'll present some historical background of how operating systems have evolved over the past 50 or so years. Okay, it's been at least 50 years since the first OS came out. Okay, so they started with the mainframes, and now we have operating systems that run on your phone and your tablet and whatnot. Okay, so the very early operating systems basically ran on very large machines, okay, like mainframe. In those days, hardware was expensive. A single machine would cost tens of millions of dollars. Okay? And humans, i.e. programmers, were relatively inexpensive. Because the amount of money or salary would pay to a programmer was negligible as compared to the amount of money would have invested in a machine. Okay? So, nevertheless, if the machine allowed only one user or one programmer to sit on the console, you could run exactly one program. You would feed the program, it would run that program, it would spit out some result. There was no notion of interactivity. So you basically submitted a job and it executed. Okay? And if the program didn't run, then you had to sit at the console and debug what happened. Okay, there were no debuggers at the time. Very primitive operating system. All they allowed you to do was submit a job, to run the job, spit out a result. Okay, that was a very early OS. And then what happened is people, operating system designers figured out that that's not the right way to make use of an expensive machine. Okay, because if you are basically sitting there feeding a job, the machine, an expensive machine is doing there sitting there doing nothing. Okay, you may as well actually feed a batch of jobs, some collection of jobs, feed them all at once and have the machine execute them one after another. That way you keep the CPU busy all the time, because it's an expensive machine. The more you use it, the more return you're getting on your expensive investment. Okay? This led to the evolution of batch processing. Okay? In batch processing, you basically submit a set of jobs or set of tasks in a batch, and then the operating system executes them one after another. Okay? So while it is loading one, it may be running the previous one. Okay, as soon as that one finishes, this one is already loaded in RAM, ready to go, starts executing the next one, and so on and so forth. So basically you load a program, run, print the results, and you repeat. Okay? This makes more efficient use of the machine. These are the first operating systems evolved from single task to batch processing systems. So this also evolves, this also sort of evolved to overlap I/O and computation. Okay, so to make even more efficient use, while you are loading a job or while you are spitting out the results of the previous job, you can run something on the CPU. Don't keep the CPU idle was basically the design goal. So you could allow overlap of I/O and computation. While there's some I/O happening, rather than keep the CPU idle, you run something else on the CPU. Okay. So this basically allows you to run more than one job essentially at the same time by overlapping CPU and I/O at the same time. Okay, when one job is doing I/O, let run another job on the CPU. So that led to further evolution of your machine. Okay. And then basically that essentially led to this notion of multi-programming, which is what you have even today. Multi-programming basically allows you to run more than one process or more than one program on your machine at the same time. This we take as a given today. Okay, you basically can double click on something and it starts a process. There may be something else that's already running at the same time, and you don't worry about it. The OS basically runs multiple processes all at the same time. Okay, so you can run more than one job at a time. OS manages the interaction and so on. Okay? So you will see that all operating systems go through the same trajectory. Okay, if you look at phone-based operating system, you are seeing the exact same thing happening. Okay, so early, so just to take a specific example, early versions of the OS on smartphones like iPhones could only run one job at a time. Okay, the most recent one does multitasking. It allows you to run more than one job at a time. Okay. All operating systems have essentially gone through the same trajectory. As hardware improves, as the demands on the hardware goes up, functionality also evolves to meet those demands. Okay, so that's the same thing that happened with early machines as well. Okay. So multi-programming was a big step. Okay. It allowed you to run arbitrary number of processes all at the same time, and thereby it allows you to make efficient use of the hardware. Okay. It allows you to ensure that the CPU doesn't have to go idle. You start up lots of jobs. If one job blocks to do I/O, you run some other job on the CPU. Thereby you can keep your CPU busy. Okay. Because machines are still expensive 30-40 years ago, you could still make good use of your processor, you could make good use of your disk and whatnot. So that's basically what resulted in this notion of multi-programming. Okay. So as OS complexity, so this, as you can see, you're already in a span of 10-15 years gone from operating system that could run only one job at any given time to a batch processing system to multi-programming system. Okay. So complexity of operating systems also continued to grow. Okay, new operating systems are designed. Some were big failures. Okay, there was a system called Multics. I presume none of you must have heard of this. It was the predecessor of Unix. Okay, it was this big project that was started at GE and MIT to basically build this massive operating system that had all sorts of functionality. Okay, it was a spectacular failure. like it didn't even work because it was so buggy. It was such a large system that was designed. They tried to cram so much functionality, they couldn't get any one thing right. It was so buggy that nobody wanted to use it. The project was eventually abandoned. Okay? And what grew out of that was Unix. Okay? Unix had a very different philosophy of keep things very simple. Okay? Unix, basically, the people who designed Unix essentially threw away all of this functionality that was there in Multics, and there is sort of kept a small number of important things, and they made those things work really well. Okay? And then that basically led to the growth of Unix, and basically Unix became the predominant operating system in the 70s and 80s. So this sort of gives you some idea of, as an operating system designer, you really have to make the right choices. Otherwise, your OS platform will be a failure. The most modern incarnation of this same kind of thing is sort of Vista. Okay, you will see sort of Vista was essentially a commercial failure because it had so many performance issues that really companies didn't adopt it in any great numbers. Okay? And there was the same reason for that, because they tried to do too many things at the same time. Eventually with Windows 7 they threw out a lot of stuff, re-architected it and made a few things that were remaining there, not a few, but the things that remained there work very well, and now it has again become more successful. So the same kind of issues come up. So as any designer of a large system, you have to make the right design choices. So that's basically the line between success and failure. And I mean, so this is basically IBM's operating system, the mainframe operating system, OS 360. When it was released, it had 1,000 known bugs. Okay, because they basically decided to ship something that had already a whole bunch of bugs, because they couldn't all fix those bugs. As they fixed, some more were introduced. Okay. So that's a problem with any large software system. Okay, when to decide that you have done enough debugging and ship things and then release patches later and whatnot. Okay. So managing complexity is key. That's basically the take-home message. Because all software systems, modern software systems, are complex entities. Yeah, they won't have like hundreds or thousands of lines of code, they have tens of millions of lines of code. Okay, managing a software system that has 10 million lines of code is a very different task from writing a program that is maybe 100 or 1000 lines. Okay, so it's basically a very different way to design software systems, and this is why there are problems. The complexity is huge, and managing that complexity is always an issue. Okay, so this is another way to look at. So now as sort of you look at the 70s, what started happening was the cost of hardware kept going down. Okay, so because of technology improvements, machines became cheaper. The cost, salaries didn't go down. Salaries of programmers basically kept going up. Okay, so now you had a scenario where hardware was cheap, but human time was more expensive. So you had to make better use of human time rather than sort of optimizing use of hardware. This basically resulted in the Unix era, where you could basically have more than one programmer use the same machine at the same time, or buy a machine for each programmer, a workstation for each programmer, and so on. So as you sort of get into the 80s, you are in the PC era. So machines become really cheap. You can buy a machine for, let's say, $2,000. Not $1 million. Okay, so practically everyone can buy one. Okay. So that basically resulted in a new set of operating system platform that were designed for personal computing. Okay. All of the operating systems until then were designed for these large machines that sat in the machine rooms of large companies and did ran programs that organizations wanted to run. In the PC era, machines started running programs that people wanted to run for entertainment or doing their work and whatnot, email and office and so on. Okay? And the PC operating systems have followed the same trajectory. Okay, so early operating system, you start with DOS, single process at a time, didn't do multi-programming. Okay, you go into Windows 3 and whatnot, you are basically back to multi-programming, and then Windows NT had good networking support and whatnot, and then GUIs, interactive consoles and so on. Okay, so same kind of trajectory. Okay. 1990s and sort of through now, you have hardware that's very cheap. Okay. So rather than having one machine per person, each of you probably accesses more than one machine without realizing it. Okay. Computing is essentially everywhere. your car probably has 4 or 5 microcontrollers accessing all of the data. Your phone has a fairly good processor, maybe 1 gigahertz processor. The laptop has 2 machines, and then you have probably several microcontrollers in home systems and whatnot. Okay. So essentially, hardware is so cheap that now you can basically put CPUs in practically any device you want. Yes, because you can get low-end thing. And then that has resulted in a whole slew of operating systems that are targeted towards several specific applications. So there are sensor operating systems. These are designed for very tiny devices that are just sensing what's in the environment. Okay, very specific variant of an operating system designed just for sensing. There are parallel operating systems that run on these humongous multi-processors. There may be machines with 200,000 processors. Okay? So you have to design specialized operating system just for that. Okay? And you have distributed operating systems that run on clusters and sort of cloud computing platforms and whatnot. Okay? So you basically have this slew of different operating system platforms that are designed for very specific types of hardware platforms. It's just not one, but now many. And then there are phone operating systems and tablet operating systems and what have you. So this basically has continued to evolve. And what that sort of also shows you is how hardware has sort of evolved over time. Okay, that's basically, if you take what happened 50 years ago and what you see now, there's around 9 orders of magnitude improvement, okay, in hardware. Okay, so basically, and then the cost has also gone down. So if you look at machine that cost $100,000 in 1983, you basically get a better machine for less than $500. Okay? In those days, you had 1 megabyte of RAM. Okay? Now, tens of gigabytes are common. Okay, network speeds have gone from 10 megabits to gigabits to 10 gigabit. Disk sizes have gone from gigabytes to terabytes. Okay, so you can buy a 1 terabyte disk for your PC for $100. Okay, probably 2 terabytes now. 1 terabyte was last year. So things basically, costs have kept going down, speeds have improved. That's really unprecedented, okay, improvement in technology. Okay, so this is basically not seen in any other domain. Okay, if you look at any other domain and the rate of technology progress, 9 orders you have not seen anywhere. If you look at transportation, okay, you basically gone from 10 miles of per hour transportation to maybe 1,000 miles an hour, okay, airplane. If you look at communication, say the communication has also improved dramatically, but it's still 10 to the power 7, okay, in terms of communication speeds, bandwidths and so on. 10 to the power 9 is actually quite amazing. Okay, so here is a picture that shows you, if you have a picture of a person, and if you zoom out 9 orders of magnitude, where you will be. Okay, that's basically the photo. Here is one, so you sort of zoom out, so it becomes 10 to the power 2. Okay, so that's that person you are seeing there, is now that 4 pixels there. Okay, and that's 10 to the power 3, that's 4, and that's 5, that's 6, 7, that's 8. And that's 9. Okay, so this is your zoom out 10 to the power 9. That is basically gives you some perspective on what sort of the order of magnitude means. Okay. So very interesting technology trend, and the operating systems are continuing to evolve in the face of constant change. Okay, and they will probably continue to evolve as new hardware comes out and as new demands are put on operating systems and so on. So in short, it's still an active area of research, okay, but what people consider as an operating system is very different from what people thought were operating system kernels maybe even 20, 30 years ago. Okay. So in the context of this course, and this is essentially what's called Moore's Law, I guess some of you must have at least heard of this term. Okay, Moore's Law is basically an observation. It's not like a law of physics, but it's an observation that was made by this person Moore, who used to work at Intel. It basically said that technology has continued to improve, so that every 18 months you will get a doubling in speed of processors or the doubling in capacities of memory. So every 18 months you will get a machine that's twice as fast or has twice as much RAM. And this basically has continued to be true for the past 30-40 years. It still continues to be sort of true today, but not quite, because there are some technology barriers that have resulted in the law not being what it is. Okay, that's why you basically don't see 100 gigahertz processors today. Okay, you're still stuck in the 2 gigahertz, but you get see more cores, okay, but you don't necessarily see faster processors. Okay, but nevertheless, it's sort of kept up for the past whatever tens of years, and that has led to where we are today. Okay, so this is something you should keep in mind. Moore's law is something that I guess all of you should know, so keep that in mind. And there are all these new features, as I said, that are coming. Today's new metric for optimization is power. How do you design operating systems that cause the machine to consume less power? Yeah, that's basically where people are spending a lot of data. And the reason for this is companies like Google are putting up very large data centers with 100,000 cores with 1 million machines. Okay? Just the electricity bill on a typical data center runs in millions of dollars a month. Okay, so typical large data center electric bill is like $3 million a month. So cost of electricity is very high for running these very large computing systems. So one interesting question that many people are looking at is how do you design operating system that does very smart power management, that turns off machines when not needed, that turns them on automatically, does all sorts of optimizations so that the power that is needed to run these machines, as well as the cooling that you have to put in place to cool all of the heat that the machine generates, is as low as possible. Okay, that's sort of the newest trend in operating system design, is to do what is called power efficient computing and design operating systems to do that. Okay, so there will be many more things, and we'll talk about some of this throughout this course. Okay, so that is basically a very quick introduction to operating systems. As I said, next time, tomorrow there is a discussion section, so do go to that, we'll hand out the first lab. But more importantly, starting on Thursday, okay, we will start with the architecture refresher and then process management. But there's one more thing I wanted to ask. I have a few travel things, commitments coming up in the next 2 weeks. Okay? So next Thursday, I have to be away. Okay? Do people have any problems if I do the Thursday's lecture on Wednesday in the discussion section and then use Thursday for the discussion section? Is that an issue for anyone? So can I swap the two things? Okay. So I might do that one more time subsequently. Okay, because I have these travel things and I don't want to miss the class. I would rather, if people are flexible, just have the Thursday lecture on Wednesday. The Wednesday's discussion section moves to Thursday. Okay, but nothing changes for this week. This is just, I'll do an announcement. I just wanted to get a poll of whether that's acceptable to people. Okay, you had a question there? Okay, I will announce. I am just trying to understand whether anybody has any problems with this. Yes.
The times aren't quite swapped, right?
Not the time. You come at the same time. The discussion section is shorter than the class, so I will have to compress some material, but we will not change the time. We will just sort of do them in a different order on that week. No, the discussion sections are not held in the lab. The discussion section is actually in the computer science building. Room 142. Yes. No, so we will basically meet in the same room that is assigned for a particular day. What happens in that slot will be different, that's all. Okay. I will announce this so there is no confusion. I just wanted to make sure this is fine. So for now, don't worry about it. When the time comes, I will make an announcement. Okay. God bless you. Alright, so that's where we will stop today. There's one more thing I wanted to sort of mention. I actually record the audio of this class. Okay, so I'm going to put up